Welcome back. This is CS50. This is the start of week 7, so it's been a while, so I thought we'd take a whirlwind tour of where we left off and where we're now going. So this thing here might have caused some angst at first, but hopefully you're beginning to acclimate to what this denotes here. Star representing a pointer, which is just what, in more layman's terms? So it's an address. So it's the address of something in memory, and we started to peel back some layers a couple of weeks ago. Things like getString and other such functions all this time have been returning addresses of things in memory, like the address of the first character in some sequence. So we also introduced Valgrind, which you'll start to use for this problem set, particularly for the next problem set as well. And Valgrind does what for us? So it checks for memory leaks, and it also checks for abuse of memory. It can, with some probability, detect if your code is going to touch memory that it simply shouldn't. So not necessarily a leak, but if you go beyond the boundaries of some array and you actually run Valgrind and induce that behavior while Valgrind is running and your program's running inside of it, you'll get messages like this, invalid write of size 4, which recall a couple of weeks ago meant that I had accidentally gone one int too far beyond the boundaries of an array. And so size 4 means here the size of that particular int. So take reassurance in the fact that Valgrind's output, the format of it, is just atrocious. It's really hard to sort of see through the mess for the interesting information. So what we've done here is just excerpt some of the couple of more interesting lines, but realize that 80% of Valgrind's output is going to be a bit of a distraction. Just look for patterns like these. Invalid write, invalid read, 40 bytes and some number of blocks are definitely lost, keywords like that. And what you'll hopefully see is some kind of trace of what function the mistake is actually in. In this case here, in what line of my code was the error apparently? 26 in a file called memory.c, which was the example we were playing with at the time. So it's probably not in malloc. It was probably in my code instead. So we'll see this again and again before long. So scanf, this came up in a couple of forms thus far. We saw scanf briefly. It was something a number of you dived into in your preparations for the quiz. And scanf is actually what the CS50 library has been using underneath the hood for quite some time in order to get input from the user. For instance, if I move over to the CS50 appliance here, let me open up an example today that's called scanf0.c, and it's super simple. It's just a few lines of code, but it demonstrates really how getInt has been working all of this time. In this program here, in line 16, notice that I declare an int. So no pointers, nothing magical there, just an int. Then in line 17, I prompt the user for a number, please. Then in line 18, I use scanf here, and I specified, kind of like printf, that I'm expecting quote-unquote %i. So %i, of course, denotes an int. But notice what the second argument to scanf is. How would you describe this second argument after the comma? What is that? It's the address of x. So this is useful because by providing scanf with the address of x, what does that empower that function to do? Not just go there, but also do what? Make a change to it. Because you can go there, it's sort of like a map to a location in memory. And so long as you provide scanf or any function with such a map, that function can go there and not only look at the value, but it can also change that value, which is useful if the purpose in life of scanf is to scan input from the user, specifically from the keyboard. And the F denotes a formatted, just like printf, the F denotes a formatted string that you want to print. So in short, this line 18 simply says, try to read an int from the user's keyboard and store it inside of x, at whatever address x happens to live at. And then lastly, line 19 just says, thanks for the int in this case. So let me go ahead and make this. So make scanf 0. Let me go ahead and zoom in. I'll go and run this with ./scanf0. Number please, 50. Thanks for the 50. So it's quite simple. Now, what is it not doing? It's not doing a whole bunch of error checking. For instance, if I don't cooperate and I don't type in a number, but instead I write something like hello, that's just kind of strange. And so one of the things the CS50 library has been doing for us for some time is that reprompting and reprompting. The retry phrase, recall, was in CS50.c, and that's the reason that getInt in the CS50 library is actually a whole bunch of lines long because we're checking for stupid stuff like this. Did the user not give us, in fact, an int? Did he or she give us something like an alphabetical letter? If so, we want to detect that and yell at them. But things get more interesting in this next example. If I go to scanf1.c, what is the one thing that is fundamentally changed in this next example? I'm using char star, of course, instead of int. So this is interesting, because char star, recall, is really just the same thing as string. So it feels like maybe this is a super simple implementation of get string, but I've peeled back the layer of the CS50 library, so I'm calling this char star now. So let's see where, if anywhere, we go wrong. Line 17, I again say, please give me something, in this case, a string. And then in the next line, I call scanf, again, giving it a format code, but this time %s. And then this time, I'm giving it buffer. Now notice I'm not using the ampersand, but why is that probably okay here? Because what is buffer already? It's already a pointer, it's already an address, and lest this word confuse, let me just call it S for instance, for simplicity, but I've called it buffer because in general in programming, if you have a chunk of memory, or which a string really just is, you might call it a buffer. It's a place to store information. Similar to things like YouTube when they're buffering, so to speak, that just means it's downloading bits from the internet and storing them in a local array, a local chunk of memory, so that you can watch it later without it skipping or hanging on you while playing back. So there's a problem here though, because I'm telling scanf, expect a string from the user, here's the address of a chunk of memory, put that string there. Why is that bound to give us trouble though? What's that? Am I allowed to access that part of memory? You know, I don't know, because has buffer been initialized to anything? Not really, and so it's what we would call, what we've been calling a garbage value, which isn't a formal word. It just means we have no idea what bits are inside of the 4 bytes that I have allocated as buffer. I have not called malloc, I've definitely not called getString, so who knows what is actually inside of buffer, and yet I'm telling scanf blindly, go there and put whatever the user typed. So what is this likely to cause in our code if we run it? Probably a seg fault. Maybe not, but probably a seg fault. And I say maybe not because sometimes you do, sometimes you don't get a seg fault, sometimes you just get lucky, but it's nonetheless going to be a bug in our program. So let me go ahead and compile this. I'm going to do it the old school way. So clang-o scanf1 scanf1.c. Enter. Oops, too old school. Let's see. Where did I go wrong? Oh, char star buffer. Oh, thank you. Save. Okay. Very old school. All right, it's been a while. So I've just saved the file after making that temporary change a moment ago, and now I have compiled it manually with Clang, and now I'm going to go ahead and run scanf1, enter, string please, I'll type in hello, and now here's where, frankly, printf is a little annoying. It's not actually going to segfault in this case. Printf is a little special because it's so super commonly used that essentially printf is doing us a favor and realizing, that's not a valid pointer. Let me take it upon myself to just print out in parentheses null, even though it's not necessarily what we ourselves expected. So we can't really easily induce a seg fault with this, but clearly this is not the behavior I wanted. So what's the simple solution? Well, in scanf2, let me propose that instead of actually just allocating a char star, let me be a little smarter about this, and let me allocate buffer as a sequence of 16 chars. So I can do this in a couple of ways. I could absolutely use malloc, but I can go back to like week 2 when I just needed a whole bunch of characters. That's just an array. So let me instead redefine buffer to be an array of 16 characters. And now when I pass buffer in, and this is something we didn't talk about in week 2, but you can treat an array as though it's an address. Technically, as we've seen, they're a little bit different, but scanf won't mind if you pass it the name of an array, because what Clang will do for us is essentially treat the name of that array as the address of the chunk of 16 bytes. So this is better. This means now that I can hopefully do the following. Let me zoom out for a moment and do make scanf2. Compiled OK. Now let me do .scanf2, string please, hello, and it seemed to work this time. But can someone propose a scenario in which it might not still work? Yeah. Something longer than 16 characters, and actually we can be a little more precise, something longer than 15 characters, because really we need to keep in mind that we need that \0 implicitly at the end of the string, which as an aside, scanf will typically take care of for us. So let me do something like, sometimes we can just leave it like that. Okay, so we've now induced our segmentation fault. Why? Because I typed more than 15 characters, and so we've actually touched memory that I actually should not have. So what's really the solution here? Well, what if we need a longer string? Well, we maybe make it 32 bytes. Well, what if that's not long enough? How about 64 bytes? What if that's not long enough? How about 128 or 200 bytes? what really is the solution here in the general case, if we don't know in advance what the user is going to type? Right? It's just kind of a big pain in the ass, to be honest, which is why the CS50 library has like a few dozen lines of code that collectively implement getString in a way that we don't have to know in advance what the user is going to type. In particular, if you look back at CS50.c from 2 weeks ago, you'll see that getString actually does not use scanf in this way. Rather, it reads one character at a time. Because the one nice thing about reading one character is we can guarantee ourselves to always have at least one char. I can just declare a char and then take these truly baby steps to just read one character in at a time from the keyboard. And then what you'll see getString does is every time it runs out of, say, 16 bytes of memory, it uses malloc, or a cousin thereof, to allocate more memory, copying the old memory into the new, and then crawling along getting one character at a time. And when it runs out of that chunk of memory, throws it away, grabs a bigger chunk of memory, copies old into new, and repeats. And it's truly a pain to actually implement something as simple as getting input from a user. So you can use scanf, you can use other similar functions, and a lot of textbooks and online examples do, but they're all vulnerable to problems like this. And ultimately, getting a seg fault's kind of annoying. It's not good for the user. But in the worst case, what does it fundamentally put your code at risk of? Some kind of attack, potentially. We talked about one such attack, overflowing the stack. But in general, if you're allowed to overflow a buffer like we did a couple of weeks ago with just writing more than hello on the stack, you can indeed take over, potentially, a computer, or at least get at data that doesn't belong to you. So in short, this is why we had those training wheels. But now we begin to take them off, as our programs no longer need necessarily input from the user. But in the case of problem set 6, your input will come from a huge dictionary file with 150-some-odd-thousand words. So you won't have to worry about the user's arbitrary input. We will give you some assumptions about that file. Are any questions on pointers or scanf or user input in general? All right, so a quick look then at one trailing topic from 2 weeks ago, and that was this notion of a struct. Not that. This notion of a struct, which was what? What did structs do for us? Define a variable type. So sort of. We are actually combining two topics. So with typedef, recall that we can declare a type of our own, like a synonym, like string for char or star. But using typedef and struct, we can create truly our own data structures. For instance, if I go back into gedit here for just a moment, and I go ahead and do something like, let me save this as, let's say, structs.c temporarily. I'm just going to go ahead and include standardio.h int main void. And then in here, suppose that I want to write a program that stores multiple students from multiple houses, for instance. So it's like a registrarial database of some sort. So if I need the name of one student, I might do something like char star name. And I'll do something like, actually, let's use the CS50 library for just a moment to make this a little simpler. So we can borrow those dozens of lines of code. And let's just keep it simple. We'll keep it string. And now get string. So I claim now that I've stored the name of some student and the house of some student, simply using variables like we did in week one. But suppose I now want to support multiple students. All right, so my instincts are to do string name 2 gets get string. String house 2 gets get string. And then third student, let's do name 3 get string. All right, so this is hopefully striking you as kind of stupid, because this process is really never going to end, and it's just going to make my code look worse and worse and worse. But we solved this too in week 2. What was our relatively clean solution when we had multiple variables of the same data type that are kind of all related, but we didn't want this atrocious mess of similarly named variables? What did we do instead? So I think I heard a few places we had an array, right? If you want multiple instances of something, why don't we clean this all up and just say, give me an array called names. And for now, let's hard code 3. And then give me another array called houses. And let me for now hard code 3. And I've massively cleaned up the mess that I just created. Now, I've still hard coded 3. But even the 3 could dynamically come from the user or argv or the like. So this is already cleaner. But what's annoying about this is that now, even though a name is somehow fundamentally linked to a student's house, right? It's a student that I really want to represent. I now have two arrays that are parallel in the sense that they're the same size and names bracket 0 presumably maps to houses bracket 0 and names bracket 1 maps to houses bracket 1. In other words, that student lives in that house and that other student lives in that other house. But surely this could be done even more cleanly. Well, it can, in fact. Let me go ahead and open up structs.h, and you'll see this idea here. Notice that I've used typedef, as you alluded to a moment ago, to declare our own data type, but I'm also using this other keyword called struct, which gives me a new data structure. And this data structure, I claim, is going to have two things inside of it, a string called name and a string called house. And the name I'm going to give to this data structure is going to be called student. Could call it anything I want, but this semantically makes sense to me in my mind. So now if I open up a better version of the program I started writing there, let me scroll to the top, and there's some more lines of code here, but let me focus for the moment on one. I've declared a constant called students and hard-coded 3 for now. But now notice how clean my code begins to get. In line 22, I declare an array of students, and notice that student is apparently now a data type, because at the top of this file, notice, I've included that header file that I pulled up just a moment ago. And that header file quite simply had this definition of a student. So now I've created my own custom data type that the authors of C years ago didn't think of in advance, but no problem, I can make it myself. So this is an array called students, each of whose members is a student structure, and I want 3 of those in the array. And now what does the rest of this program do? I needed something a little arbitrary. So from line 24 onward, I iterate from 0 to 3. I then ask the user for the student's name, and then I use getString as before. Then I ask for the student's house, and I use getString as before. But notice, slightly new piece of syntax. I can still index to the ith student, but how do I get at the specific data field inside of the struct? Well, what's apparently the new piece of syntax? It's just the dot operator. We've not really seen this before. You've seen it in pset 5 if you've dived in already with bitmap files, but the dot just means inside of this struct are multiple fields, give me dot name or give me dot house. That means go inside of the struct and get those particular fields. What does the rest of this program do? It's not all that sexy. Notice that I iterate from 0 to 3 again, and I simply create an English phrase like so-and-so is in such and such a house, passing in dot name from the ith student and their house as well. And then lastly, and now we'll start to get anal about this now that we're familiar with what malloc and other functions have been doing all this time, why do I have to free both name and house, even though I did not call malloc? Getstring did, right? And that was the dirty little secret for several weeks, but getstring has been leaking memory all over the place all semester thus far, and Valgrind will finally reveal this to us, but it's not a big deal because I know that I can simply free the name and the house, though technically to be super, super safe, I should be doing some error checking here. What are your instincts telling you? What should I be checking for before I free what is a string, aka a char star? I should really be checking if students bracket I dot name does not equal null, then it'll be okay to go ahead and free that pointer, and same for the other one as well. If students bracket I dot house is not equal to null, this now will protect me against the corner case in which getString returned something like null. And we saw a moment ago, printf will kind of protect us up here by just saying null, which is going to look weird, but at least it won't segfault as we have seen. Well, let me do one other thing here. Structs 0 is kind of a stupid program because I enter all this data and then it's lost once the program ends. But let me go ahead and do this. Let me make the terminal window a bit bigger. Let me make structs-1, which is a new version of this. I'll zoom in a little bit. And now let me run dot slash structs 1, student's name, David Mather. Okay, let's do Rob Kirkland. Let's do Lauren Leverett. But what's interesting now is notice, and I only know this because I wrote the program, there's a file now in my current directory called students.csv. Some of you might have seen these in the real world. What's a CSV file? comma-separated values. It's sort of like a poor man's version of an Excel file. It's a table of rows and columns that you can open in a program like Excel or Numbers on a Mac. And if I open this file here on gedit, notice, and the numbers aren't there, that's just gedit telling me line numbers, notice on the first line of this file is David and Mather, the next line is Rob, comma, Kirkland, and the third line is Lauren, comma, Leverage. So what have I created? I've now written a C program that effectively can generate spreadsheets that can be opened in a program like Excel. Not all that compelling a data set, but if you have much larger chunks of data that you actually want to manipulate and make graphs of and the like, this is perhaps one way to create that data. Moreover, CSVs are actually super common just for storing simple data. Yahoo Finance, for instance, if you get stock quotes via their so-called API, the free service that lets you get current, up-to-the-date stock quotes for companies, they give the data back in this super simple CSV format. So how did we do that? Well, notice most of this program's almost the same, but notice down here, rather than print the students out, on line 35 onward, I claim that I'm saving the students to disk, so saving a file. So notice I'm declaring a file star. Now, this is kind of an anomaly in C. For whatever reason, file is all caps, which is not like most other data types in C. But this is a built-in data type, file star, and I'm declaring a pointer to a file, is how you can think of that. fopen means open file. What file do you want to open? I want to open a file that I will arbitrarily call students.csv. Could call that anything I want. And then take a guess. What does the second argument to fopen probably mean? Write. W for write. Could be R for read. There's A for append if you want to just add rows and not overwrite the whole thing. But I just want to create this file once, so I'll use quote unquote W. And I know that only from having read the documentation or the man page. If file is not null, in other words, if nothing went wrong there, let me iterate over the students from 0 to 3. And now notice there's something ever so slightly different about line 41 here. It's not printf, it's fprintf for file printf. So it's going to write to a file. Which file? The one whose argument, whose pointer you specify is the first argument. Then we specify a format string. Then we specify what string we want to plug in for the first percent s, and then another percent s for another variable for the second percent s. Then we close the file with fclose. Then I free the memory as before, though I should go back in and add some checks for null. And that's it, right? fopen, fprintf, fclose gives me the ability to create text files. Now, you'll see in problem set 5, which involves images, you'll be using binary files instead. But fundamentally, the idea is the same, even though the functions you'll see are a little bit different. So whirlwind tour, but you will get all too familiar with file I/O, input and output, with PSET 5. But any questions about the initial basics here? Yeah. What if you try to free a null value? I believe, unless free has gotten a little more user-friendly, you can potentially segfault. Passing it null is bad, because I don't believe free bothers to check for you, because it would potentially be a waste of time for it to do it itself for everyone in the world. Good question, though. All right, so this kind of gets us to an interesting topic. The theme of problem set 5 is forensics. At least that's a portion of the problem set. Forensics generally refers to the recovery of information that may have or may not have been deleted deliberately. And so I thought I'd give you a quick taste of what is really going on all this time underneath the hood of your computer. For instance, if you have inside of your laptop, your desktop computer, a hard drive, it's either a mechanical device that actually spins. There's little circular things called platters that look quite like what I just had up on the screen here, though this is increasingly old school. This is a 3.5-inch hard drive, and 3.5 inches refers to the width of the thing when you install it in a computer. Many of you guys in your laptops now have solid-state drives, or SSDs, which have no moving parts. They're more like RAM and less like these mechanical devices, but the ideas are still the same, certainly as they relate to problem set 5. And if you think about now, a hard drive represents being a circle, which I'll draw like this here. When you create a file on your computer, whether it's an SSD or in this case an older school hard drive, that file comprises multiple bits. Let's say that it's this 0 and 1, a whole bunch of zeros and 1. So this is my whole hard drive. This is apparently a pretty big file, and it is using up the zeros and 1s at that portion of the physical platter. Well, what is that physical portion? Well, it turns out that on a hard drive, at least of this type, there's these tiny little magnetic particles. And they essentially have north and south poles to them. So that if you turn one of those magnetic particles this way, you might say that it's representing a 1. And if it's upside down, south to north, you might say that it's representing a 0. So in the real physical world, that's how you could represent something in binary state of a 0 and a 1. So that's all a file is. It's a whole bunch of magnetic particles that are either this way or this way, creating patterns of zeros and ones. But it turns out when you save a file, some information is saved separately. So this is a little table, a directory, so to speak. And I'll call this column name, and I'll call this column location. And I'm going to say that, suppose this is my resume. My resume.doc is stored at location, let's say, 123. I always go for that number. But suffice it to say that just like in RAM, you can take a hard drive that's a gigabyte or 200 gigabytes or a terabyte, and you can number all of the bytes. You can number all chunks of 8 bits. So we'll say that this is location 123. So this directory inside of my operating system remembers that my resume is at location 123. But it gets interesting when you delete a file. So for instance, and thankfully most of the world has caught on to this, what happens when you drag a file to your macOS trash or your Windows recycle bin? What's the purpose of doing that? It's obviously to get rid of the file, but what is the act of dragging and dropping into your trash or recycle bin do on a computer? It's like absolutely nothing, really. It's just like a folder. It's a special folder, to be sure, but does it actually delete the file? Well, no, because some of you have probably been like, oh, damn, you didn't mean to do that, so you double-click the trash or recycle bin, you've poked around, and you've recovered the file just by dragging it out of there. So clearly, it's not necessarily deleting it. But OK, you're smarter than that, right? You know that just dragging it into the trash or recycle bin doesn't mean you're emptying the trash. So you go up to the menu, and you say empty trash or empty recycle bin. Then what happens? Yeah, so it is deleted in more so, but all that happens is this. The computer forgets where resume.doc was. But what has not changed, apparently, in the picture? The bits, right? The zeros and ones that I claim are on side of some physical aspect of the hardware, they're still there. It's just the computer has forgotten what they are. So it's essentially freed the file's bits so that they can be reused. But not until you create more files and more files and more files will probabilistically those zeros and ones, those magnetic particles, get reused upside or right side up for other files, zeros and ones. So you have this window of time, and it's not of predictable length, really. It depends on the size of your hard drive and how many files you have and how quickly you make new ones. But there's this window of time during which that file is still perfectly recoverable. So if you ever use programs like McAfee or Norton to try to recover data, all they're doing is trying to recover this so-called directory to figure out where your file was. And sometimes Norton will say, file is 93% recoverable. Well, what does that mean? That just means that some other file, coincidentally, ended up using, say, those bits out of your original file. So what isn't actually involved in recovering data? Well, if you don't have something like Norton pre-installed on your computer, the best you can sometimes do is look at the entire hard drive looking for patterns of bits. And one of the themes of problem set 5 is that you will search the equivalent of a hard drive, a forensic image of a compact flash card from a digital camera, searching for the zeros and ones that typically, with high probability, represent the start of a JPEG image. And you guys can recover those images by assuming, if I see this pattern of bits on the forensic image, with high probability, that marks the start of a JPEG. And if I see the same pattern again, that probably marks the start of another JPEG, and another JPEG, and another JPEG. And this is typically how data recovery will work. What's nice about JPEGs is even though the file format itself is somewhat complex, the beginning of every such file is actually fairly identifiable and simple, as you will see if you've not already. So let's take a closer look underneath the hood as to exactly what's been going on and what these zeros and ones are to give you a bit more of a context for this particular challenge.
Where your PC stores most of its permanent data. To do that, the data travels from RAM along with software signals that tell the hard drive how to store that data. The hard drive circuits translate those signals into voltage fluctuations. These in turn control the hard drive's moving parts, some of the few moving parts left in the modern computer. Some of the signals control a motor which spins metal-coated platters. Your data is actually stored on these platters. Other signals move the read-write heads to read or write data on the platters. This machinery is so precise that a human hair couldn't even pass between the heads and spinning platters. Yet, it all works at terrific speeds.
Zoom in a little deeper now at what's actually on those platters.
Let's look at what we just saw in slow motion. When a brief pulse of electricity is sent to the read-write head, it flips on a tiny electromagnet for a fraction of a second. The magnet creates a field, which changes the polarity of a tiny, tiny portion of the metal particles which coat each platter surface. A patterned series of these tiny charged up areas on the disc represents a single bit of data in the binary number system used by computers. Now, if the current is sent one way through the read-write head, the area is polarized in one direction. If the current is sent in the opposite direction, the polarization is reversed. How do you get data off the hard disk? Just reverse the process. So it's the particles on the disk that get the current in the read-write head moving. Put together millions of these magnetized segments and you've got a file. Now, the pieces of a single file may be scattered all over a drive's platters, kind of like the mess of papers on your desk. So a special extra file keeps track of where everything is. Don't you wish you had something like that?
Probably not. But, so, how many of you guys grew up with these? Okay, so it's fewer and fewer hands every year, but I'm glad you were at least familiar with them, because this and our phone book demo, sadly, are dying a very slow death here of familiarity. But this is like what I, at least, back in high school, used to use for backups, and it was amazing, because you could store, 1.4 megabytes on this particular disk. And this was the high-density version, as indicated by the HD, which has a meaning before today's HD videos. Standard density was 800 kilobytes, and before that, there were 400-kilobyte disks, and before that, there were 5 1/4-inch disks, which were truly floppy and a little wider and taller than these things here. But you can actually see the so-called floppy aspect of these disks, and functionally, they're actually pretty similar to hard drives of at least this type. Again, SSDs and newer computers will work a little differently, but if you move that little metal tab, you can actually see a little cookie or platter. It's not metal like this one. This one's actually some cheaper plastic material, and you can kind of wiggle it, and you've truly just wiped off some number of bits or magnetic particles from this disk. So thankfully, there's nothing on it. If that thing's in the way, and cover your eyes on those of your neighbor, you can just kind of pull this whole sheath off like that, but there's a little spring, so beware of that with your eyes. So now you have truly a floppy disk, and what's remarkable about this is that in as much as this is a small-scale representation of a larger hard drive, these things are super, super simple. If you pinch the bottom of it now, that metal thing's off, and peel them open, all there is like two pieces of felt and the so-called floppy disk with a piece of metal on the inside, and there goes, you know, half of my disk's contents, there goes another half of them, but that's all that was spinning inside of your computer in yesteryear. And again, to put this into perspective, how big is most of your hard drives these days? 500 gigabytes, a terabyte, maybe in a desktop computer, 2 terabytes, 3 terabytes, 4 terabytes, right? This is 1 megabyte, give or take, which can't even fit a typical MP3 anymore these days, or some similar music file. So a little souvenir for you today, and also to help contextualize what we'll be taking for granted now in problem set 5. So those are yours to keep. So, all right. So let me transition to where we'll be spending the next piece set as well. So we've now set the stage for a couple of announcements quickly. Friday, this Friday, if you would like to join CS50 for lunch, go to the usual place, cs50.net/RSVP. And final project. So per the syllabus, we've posted the final project specification already. Realize that that doesn't mean it's due particularly soon. It's posted really just to get you guys thinking about it. And indeed, a super significant percentage of you will be tackling final projects on material that we haven't gotten to in the class, but will as early as next week. Notice, though, that the spec calls for a few different components of the final project. The first in a few weeks is a pre-proposal, a pretty casual email to your TF to tell him or her what you're thinking about for your project with no commitment. Proposal will be your particular commitment saying, here, this is what I'd like to do for my project. What do you think? Too big? Too small? Is it manageable? And you see the spec for more details. A couple of weeks after that is the status report, which is a similarly casual email to your TF to say just how far behind you are in your final project's implementation, followed by the CS50 hackathon, to which everyone is invited, which will be an event from 8 p.m. on one evening till 7 a.m. the next morning. Pizza, as I may have mentioned in week zero, will be served at 9 p.m., Chinese food at 1 a.m., and if you're still awake at 5 a.m., we'll take you to IHOP for breakfast. So the hackathon is one of the more memorable experiences in the class. Then the implementation is due, and then the climactic CS50 fair. More details on all of these in the weeks to come. But let's go back to something old school, again an array. So an array was nice because it solves problems like we saw just a moment ago with student structures getting a little out of control if we want to have student 1, student 2, student 3, student dot, 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 some arbitrary number of students. So arrays a few weeks ago swooped in and solved all of our problems of not knowing in advance how many things of some type we might want. And we've seen that structs can help us further organize our code and keep conceptually similar variables like a name and a house together so that we can treat them as one entity inside of which there are smaller pieces. But arrays have some disadvantages. What are some of the disadvantages we've encountered with arrays thus far? What's that? Fixed size. So even though you might be able to allocate memory for an array, once you know how many students you have, how many characters you have from the user, once you've allocated the array, you've kind of painted yourself into a corner because you cannot insert new elements into the middle of an array. You can't insert more elements at the end of an array. Really, you have to resort to creating a whole new array, as we've discussed, copying the old into the new. And again, that is the headache that GetString deals with for you. But again, you can't even insert something into the middle of the array if the array isn't entirely filled. For instance, if this array here of size 6 only has 5 things in it, well, it'd be not, you could just tack something onto the end, but what if you want to insert something into the middle of the array, even though it might have 5 out of 6 things in it? Well, what did we do when we had all of our human volunteers on stage in weeks past? If we wanted to put someone here, either these people had to move this way, or these people had to move this way, and that became expensive, right? The shifting of people inside of an array ended up adding up and costing us time, hence a lot of our n squared running times like insertion sort, for instance, in the worst case. So arrays are great, but you have to know in advance how big you want them. So okay, here's the solution. If I don't know in advance how many students I might have, and I know once I decide, though, I'm stuck with that many students, why don't I just always allocate twice as much space as I might think I need? Is that not a reasonable solution? Right, realistically, I don't think that we're going to need more than 50 slots in an array for a medium-sized class. So let's just round up. I'll make 100 slots in my array just so that we can definitely fit the number of students I expect to be in some medium-sized class. So why not just round up and allocate more memory typically for an array than you think you might even need? Well, what's the simple pushback to that idea? You're just wasting memory, right? Literally every program you write then is maybe using twice as much memory as you actually need, and that just doesn't feel like a particularly elegant solution. Moreover, it just decreases the probability of a problem. If you happen to have a popular course one semester and you have 101 students, your program is still fundamentally facing the same issue. So thankfully, there's a solution to this and all of our problems in the form of data structures that are more complex than the ones we've seen thus far. This, I claim, is a linked list. This is a list of numbers, 9, 17, 22, 26, and 34, that have been linked together by way of what I've drawn as arrows. In other words, if I wanted to represent an array, I could do something like this, and I'll put this on the overhead in just a moment. I could do, stand by, new computer here, clear. All right, so if I have these numbers in an array, 9, 17, 22, 26, 34, not necessarily to scale. All right, so here is my array. Oh, my God. All right, so here is my array. Okay. Oh, my God. Pretend it's too much effort to go back and fix that. So there, 26. So we have this array of 9, 17, 22, 26, and 34. For those of you who can't see the embarrassing mistake I just made, there it is. So I claim that this is a very efficient solution. I've allocated as many ints as I need, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. And I've then stored the numbers inside of this array. But suppose then I want to insert a value like the number 8 Well, where does it go? Suppose I want to insert a number like 20. Well, where does it go? Somewhere there in the middle, or the number 35 has to go somewhere at the end. But I'm all out of space. And so this is a fundamental challenge of arrays that does have a solution. Right? I claimed a moment ago, getString solves this problem. If you want to insert in a sixth number into this array, what is at least one solution you can fall back on for sure, just like we do with getString? What's that? Well, make it bigger is easier said than done. We can't necessarily make the array bigger, but what can we do? Make a new array that's bigger, of size 6 or maybe size 10 if we want to get ahead of things, and then copy the old array into the new, and then free the old array. But what's the running time now of that process? It's big O of n, right? Because the copying is going to cost you some units of time. So not so ideal if we have to allocate a new array, which is going to consume twice as much memory temporarily, copy old into new. I mean, it's just a headache, which is, again, why we wrote getString for you. So what might we do instead? Well, what if our data structure actually has gaps in it? Suppose that I relax my goal of having contiguous chunks of memory, where 9 is right next to 17, which is right next to 22, and so on. And suppose that 9 can be over here in RAM, and 17 can be over here in RAM, and 22 can be over here in RAM. In other words, I don't need them even back to back anymore. I just have to somehow thread a needle through each of these numbers, or each of these nodes, as we'll call the rectangles as I've drawn them, to remember how to get to the last such node from the first. So what is the programming construct we've seen quite recently with which I can implement that thread, or drawn here, with which I can implement those arrows? So pointers, right? If I allocate not just an int, but a node, and by node I just mean container, and visually I mean a rectangle. So a node apparently needs to contain two values, the int itself, and then, as implied by the bottom half of the rectangle, enough space for an int. So just thinking ahead here, how big is this node, this container in question? How many bytes for the int? Presumably 4, if it's the same as usual. And then how many bytes for the pointer? 4. So this container, or this node, is going to be an 8-byte structure. Oh, and that's kind of a happy coincidence that we just introduced this notion of a struct, or a C structure. So I claim that if I want to take a step toward this more sophisticated implementation of a list of numbers, a linked list of numbers, I need to do a little more thinking up front and declare not just an int, but a struct that I'll call conventionally here node. We could call it anything we want, but node is going to be thematic in a lot of the things we start looking at now. Inside of that node is an int n, and then this syntax is a little weird at first glance, struct node star next. Well, pictorially, what is that? That is the bottom half, whoops, that is the bottom half of the rectangle that we saw just a moment ago. But why am I saying struct node star as opposed to just node star, right? Because if that pointer is pointing at another node, it's just the address of a node, right? That's consistent with what we've discussed with about pointers thus far. But why, if I claim this structure is called node, do I have to say struct node inside here? Exactly. It's sort of a stupid reality of C. The type def, so to speak, hasn't happened yet. C is super literal. It reads your code top to bottom, left to right. And until it hits that semicolon on the bottom line, guess what doesn't exist as a data type? Node, quote unquote node. But because of the more verbose declaration I did on the first line, type def, struct node, because that came first before the curly braces, that's sort of like pre-educating Clang that, you know what, give me a struct called struct node. Frankly, I don't like calling things struct node all throughout my code, but I'll only use it once, just inside, so that I can effectively create a sort of circular reference. Not a pointer to myself per se, but a pointer to another structure of an identical type. So it turns out that on a data structure like this, there's a few operations that might be of interest to us. We might want to insert into a list like this. We might want to delete from a list like this. We might want to search the list for a value, or more generally, traverse. And traverse is just a fancy way of saying start at the left and move all the way to the right. And notice, even with this slightly more sophisticated data structure, let me propose that we can borrow some of the ideas of the past 2 weeks and implement a function called search like this. It's going to return true or false, indicating yes or no n is in the list. Its second argument is a pointer to the list itself, so a pointer to a node. All I'm going to then do is declare a temporary variable. We'll call it PTR by convention for pointer, and assign it equal to the beginning of the list. And now notice the while loop. So long as pointer is not equal to null, I'm going to check, is pointer arrow n equal to the n that was passed in? And wait a minute, new piece of syntax. What is the arrow all of a sudden? Yeah. Exactly. So whereas a few minutes ago we used the dot notation to access something inside of a struct, if the variable you have is not the struct itself, but a pointer to a struct, thankfully a piece of syntax that finally makes intuitive sense, the arrow means to follow the pointer, like the arrows typically mean pictorially, and go at the data field inside. So arrow is the same thing as dot, but you use it when you have a pointer. So just to recap then, if the n field inside of the struct called pointer equals equals n, return true. Otherwise, this line here, pointer equals pointer next. So what this is doing, notice, is if I am currently pointing at the struct containing 9, and 9 is not the number I'm looking for, suppose I'm looking for n equals 50, I'm going to update my temporary pointer to not point at this node anymore, but pointer arrow next, which is going to put me up here. Now, I realize this is a whirlwind introduction. On Wednesday, we'll actually do this with some humans and with some more code at a slower pace. But realize we're now making our data structures more complex so that our algorithms can get more efficient, which is going to be requisite for PSET 6 when we load in, again, those 150,000 words, but need to do so efficiently and ideally create a program that runs for our users, not in linear, not in n squared, but in constant time in the ideal. We'll see you on Wednesday.
At the next CS50, David forgets his base case.
And that's how you send text messages with C.
What the?